And welcome to the Podluck, serving up bite-sized tastes of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Grab a plate and let's dig in. Hey, y'all, and we are back. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Podluck. As always, I'm your host, Megan Westra. So there has been just a whole lot going on. We have been in the midst of this Corona kegger season and talking about all manner of things related to the coronavirus or that we were thinking about during coronavirus. And let's just be real clear. The pandemic is not over by any stretch of the imagination. But we also need to address some other things as well. In the last month, we have seen unspeakable acts of police brutality and racism in our country. And we have also seen really unprecedented levels of response and movement towards solidarity and mass protests and just a truly remarkable time all around. So we're going to press pause today on the Corona kegger season. And we have been. I haven't published an episode, or not published. This isn't writing. This is audio produced. Trying to think of what the word is. Anyway, there hasn't been a new episode of the Podluck for a couple weeks. And part of that was intentional. There were so many important, good, valuable podcasts coming out that I was listening to, that I was learning from. I also finished seminary in the last month, graduated officially, but not with a ceremony yet because pandemic is not over. So just taking a breath to sit with all that. And I'm going to drop some links in the show notes of different conversations and different podcasts that I was turning my attention to continue to learn and listen and grow in my own practice of anti-racism and my own attempts to deconstruct and divest myself of white supremacy. So I'll drop some of those suggestions in the show notes if you would like to go and listen as well. I would highly encourage you to do so. But today, before we get back into our coronavirus episodes, our Corona kegger episodes, of which there are still several, and I'm super excited to air them for you, and there's such good content there. Today, I want to draw our attention to a conversation that I got to have with two pastors and activists up in Minneapolis. I think it's so important that when we have moments like the murder of George Floyd and then the protests and the outcry that sparked there in Minneapolis and spread truly around the world, I think it's so important that we take the time to listen to the people on the ground, to listen to the people in the community where these kind of national watershed moments originate, because oftentimes there's things that get lost in the conversation the further out from that community you get. And that, you know, I say that with it's just an observation. In Milwaukee in 2016, we had some unrest after an officer-involved shooting. And it was about 8 blocks from my house. So I was pretty well aware of what was going on. It was striking to me what the difference was between what I could see on the ground in my neighborhood by my house and going out and walking and working with organizers and things like that in that season versus what I saw broadcasted on the news. And again, that's just a non-judgmental observation. That just is what it is. And so, I want to center the voices of people who have been on the ground in Minneapolis, their account, their story, as we have this conversation. And it is not going to be the full conversation today. We divided our conversation into two pieces. And so here's what we're going to do. In this first episode, Nathan and Lawrence are going to be sharing with us about questions that you may be asking about Minneapolis. Why now? What made it, like, what did everybody get so upset about this time, right? Or like, why did this particular instance of a officer involved shooting of a state sanctioned murder, why did this one garner so much attention? So questions like that. And then to help you get your grounding in what's been happening in Minneapolis for truly decades and decades. And then to take that as almost like a scaffolding, to take what they share about Minneapolis and use it as a way to interrogate your own community, to ask questions of your own community. Because as we are also aware and becoming increasingly so, racism and white supremacy are not just issues in certain communities or in some cities or in, you know, the rural South, right? Like, this is Minneapolis we're talking about. That's in the North. It's in a state that in a lot of ways often gets held up as like, yeah, like there's good progressive leadership and, you know, lots of different things going on that sound really good. And there's still prevalent racism and systemic inequality based on race. So I think to help us all be equipped to ask better questions of our communities, because all of our communities are affected by white supremacist institutions and policies, often that were enacted years and years and years and years ago. And so if we don't ask better questions, if we don't make smarter demands of the systems of which we are a part, then we continue to perpetuate things that are harmful and exclusionary and far too often deadly. So that's going to be the first part of our conversation, helping you understand a little bit more about what's going on specific to Minneapolis, and then using that as a scaffolding to ask better questions in your own community, whether you're in a major metropolitan area or super small town, rural America. And then the second part of the conversation, which will air later this week, we're going to be talking about white people who are entering this conversation either for the first time or fairly recently, or maybe you've been in the conversation for racial equity and racial justice for a while. And right now we are given the opportunity to do some assessment work of how we as white people are showing up. How is that benefiting the cause of racial justice and equity? And how are we perhaps participating in further harm or just making things way more complicated or being unhelpful? And so we'll be having that conversation as well. That'll be airing later in the week this week. And look, I know that there's so many different angles that we could take. There's so much valuable work to be done right now. And talking about what the role of white people is just a teeny tiny part of that and should not be the center of that work. And I am also aware that I am a white person. And that so much of the work that I have needed to do over the years that I continue to need to do in my own life is to do that assessing work of saying, how am I showing up? And is the way that I'm showing up, regardless of my intentions, is the impact of my engagement helpful or harmful? And so while there are many, many ways to engage the conversation, that's going to be the way that we engage later this week, is to kind of do like a debrief, like post-game tape or, you know, other analogy, you can talk with the band after the set list or whatever, right? Like to sit down and say like, okay, what went well, what did not, and to continue to grow in our ability to look at our intentions and our impact and to assess them and to listen to others in that regard. So that'll be part two of the conversation coming later this week. All right. So for our guests, first of all, we have returning to the podluck, longtime friend of the pod, Nathan Roberts. Nathan serves as the director of community engagement at First Lutheran Church in Columbia Heights, Minnesota. He's the founding editor of the Salt Collective magazine, and he spent a year as the guest on a progressive weekly, or as a guest progressive on a weekly live radio show on Fox Radio affiliate Twin Cities News Talk, Closing Argument with Walter Hudson, where he discussed progressive politics, faith, and culture. Nathan is also the co-founder and U.S. director of the Daylight Center and School in Kenya. You can contact Nathan for all kinds of opportunities, speaking and writing and everything like that through Twitter, Facebook, or email him. I'll put his email address in the show notes. So he did a Corona Kegger episode earlier this year on having conversations with people that we disagree with politically. So I'll also make sure that I link back to that episode. So we're welcoming Nathan back. And then also our second guest for today is the Reverend Lawrence T. Richards. Lawrence is a pastor, prophet, digital evangelist, and author. He is the graduate of St. Catherine University and Liberty Seminary, where he was trained in sociology, communications, pastoral care, evangelism, and Christian ministry. Reverend Richardson has also completed certifications for anti-racism facilitator training, Our Whole Lives sexuality training, church planting, digital media strategy, and executive leadership coaching. Reverend Richardson is on staff as the lead minister at Linden Hills United Church of Christ and is a media trainer for Auburn Seminary and works as an executive clergy coach for the Center for Progressive Renewal. Reverend Richardson also has active partnerships with the Evangelical Church of Germany, collaborating on digital ministry projects. He's the author of I Know What Heaven Looks Like. Reverend Richardson writes about and advocates for LGBTQ people, people of color, and the flourishing of all, with his works appearing in the Huffington Post Religion, The Root, Believe Out Loud, The Salt Collective, Rachel Murr's Unnatural Spiritual Resiliency and Queer Christian Women, Austin Hartke's Transforming the Bible and the Lives of Transgender Christians, and numerous national and international publications. Reverend Richardson has received awards and commendations for his service, including the Humanitarian Award from Black Trans Man, Inc., and the Stellar Award for his work in global communication. When he is not ministering, researching, or writing about what he researches, Pastor Lawrence loves reading, trying different cuisine, traveling, spending time with family, and empowering people to live life from a place of joy, abundance, faith, and gratitude. You can read more about him and his work on his website, which I will put the link to in the show notes. And so I'm so grateful to have been joined by Lawrence and Nathan for this conversation. And I hope that you will join us for both parts of this here on the Podluck this week. So grab a plate. Let's dig in. We're going to start the conversation this evening with helping people understand race policing and just kind of Minneapolis as a city. Just from my own experience when Milwaukee had riots back in 2016, there were a lot of people who were outside of Milwaukee who didn't really understand what was going on because they didn't know what had happened already. And so I'm hoping that you all can help our listeners today just get grounded in what has been forming this moment in Minneapolis.
I think one of the things that is important for people to understand as they look at what's happening in Minneapolis, especially if you don't have a foundational understanding of the layout of the city, is to understand that Minneapolis is a very segregated city. And it's segregated by design. Like many cities that enacted redlining, in the 1930s, there was a city council plan passed. And they designated different areas as, they didn't explicitly say that different neighborhoods were for different people of color and different races. They used a system called redlining, which designated neighborhoods as best, not as good, and not very good at all. And the not very good at all was the red neighborhoods. And those are the only neighborhoods in the 1930s that Black and Latino families were allowed to settle in Minneapolis and in St. Paul. As more and more Black and minority and Jewish neighbors were coming from other areas, leaving the Jim Crow South, where there was terrorism against Black bodies through lynchings and public acts of Ku Klux Klan terrorism. And so as people moved north, there were neighborhoods that were designated where people of color could live. And those are still dominantly Black, Latino, and now there are more and more white folks living in those neighborhoods. But those neighborhoods in the 1930s that were designated for minorities and people of color are the neighborhoods that even now are hosting the protests. The neighborhoods that now we're seeing a flashpoint between police and the neighbors. That's also because once these neighborhoods got designated that way, there was a huge amount of white folks in the 1950s. And so the few neighbors that were white left, which caused decreasing housing prices. And because housing prices determine property value and our schools in Minnesota are funded by property taxes, if your housing price isn't worth very much, as they were in these neighborhoods, then your schools really suffered. And so we started to see a full collapse of social structures in these neighborhoods. And as that was happening, the police were increasingly ramping up their presence and enforcement, and were sent in very much a military style subdue and control. They were also meant as sentinels between white and non-white neighborhoods. In the 1950s. After desegregation was formally outlawed, Minnesota began to have what we call sundown towns, which were towns where the police made it very clear to people of color in first-ring suburbs or in wealthy neighborhoods that if any people of color were caught in their neighborhood after sundown, they would be beat up, brought downtown, processed, and then returned home. And so it was sort of a soft segregation, a sort of real estate Jim Crow that was put in place in Minnesota to continue to keep people apart. Highways were put between the segregated neighborhoods. It was very difficult to catch buses across. And so what we saw in these segregated neighborhoods was two very, very different approaches to policing. In the white neighborhoods, the police officers were not always super helpful, but they were at least not as abusive. They might give you a break. They might let you off with a warning. Whereas in Black and Latino communities, they were looking to incarcerate people at huge rates, looking to beat people up, looking to intimidate, looking to bully. So we really had a tale of two policing in Minneapolis. And it kind of was almost like Malfoy, where Malfoy is so good. And, you know, you have these teen bullies that show up in one setting and are like the teacher's pet. And then they show up in another environment and are their true bully selves, which kept this policing issue hidden and the segregation in housing.
Thank you, Nathan, for your words. And I, you know, just want to say thank you for having me on the show. I want to add to that, in addition to there being a tale of two policing, we also talk about, you know, the tale of two cities and how time and time again, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul, the Twin Cities, are rated really high for white people to live, to work, to raise children. And in time and time again, the results are reversed for people of color, especially Black people. And I want to say that it certainly has to do a lot with the redlining. It certainly has to do a lot with the way that communities are structured, and then as a result, the way that resources are then available to those communities. A lot of the wealthier first ring suburbs or communities that are predominantly white have the better schools and have access to better community resources than people of color. And in addition to that, I also want to add that 1 in 3 Black men will be incarcerated in his lifetime. And that is because the way that policing has been designed, it has been to reinforce this idea that some communities need to be protected from other communities. And it speaks to what Nathan was saying in terms of the police becoming almost a buffer in Minneapolis specifically between Black people and white people. And we see how that plays out in terms of sentencing. There are sentencing disparities between the sentences that Black women and Black men receive versus the sentences for the same crimes that Black or white women and white men receive. There's also a need for bail reform because for nonviolent offenses, there are many, many Black and Latino people, especially and indigenous people in our jails for small amounts of money that they can't afford because of structured and systemic racism. And so versus there are people who are white committing those same nonviolent crimes and are able to afford that bail. And so we don't see as many of the same kinds of punishment and reward, I guess, for communities of color and white communities. I'll also add that once communities of color, once we enter the system, it begins to get more challenging to navigate society outside of that system. And so in Minnesota, we find that, 70% of, all white families own homes, and that number is less than half for Black communities. And you look at how many schools that are being integrated currently. When integration projects started in Minneapolis and St. Paul during the 70s, and so I think about if the neighborhoods are still segregated and the schools are still integrating and policing is ramped up to protect Black communities and or white communities from Black communities. And then there is a disparity in sentencing and access to bail. It is very important to make those links between what we are experiencing now in Minneapolis and all of those variables that have contributed to people feeling a sense of hopelessness, and also a sense of optimism about what changes are possible if we really shed light on the disparities that are present in this system.
Yeah, I think it's so good for us to start to link those together, especially if you're not from Minneapolis, if you're not in these communities, that it's not just this one thing, it's all of these things linked together. So I think that really helps us get grounded in that.
I think one other thing that I would add, so I grew up in the suburbs, in a wealthy white suburb, and now in a not very policed neighborhood. And now I live in a heavily policed neighborhood in South Minneapolis, about 5 blocks from the precinct that was burned down and about 5 blocks from where George Floyd was murdered. And so one thing that I noticed when I moved to a heavily policed neighborhood was that things that many of my friends did in the suburbs, like smoking weed in the parks, jaywalking, things, truancy, not going to class, speeding. In my wealthy white suburb, none of these offenses required police interaction. It would not trigger a police interaction to be doing these things. It might trigger a call to the pastor. It might trigger a call to parents. It might trigger a call to the coach, schools. But wealthy white suburbanites were pretty good at not getting their children involved because there was a common understanding that you didn't want that on your child's record.
Right. Yep.
And now that I'm an educator in a highly policed neighborhood, these same small offenses become occasions for police interaction in my diverse neighborhood. The same things that I would do because I was a teenager and I wasn't paying attention or I didn't want to be at home or are now all triggering police interactions. Mm-hmm. And when you have regular interactions with the police like that, each time you have a regular interaction for a low-level offense, it either ends up in an arrest or frustration and resentment.
And Nathan, you know, I grew up in the city, quite opposite experience. I grew up always seeing police in my school, in my high school, in full uniform, police cars always parked in the parking lot or in front of the school or circling my block. It was normal to understand that the police were not there for me. The police were there perhaps to protect property or to protect other people, but they were not there to protect me because I'm Black. And there are countless examples of calling the police for whatever reason as a child and seeing the police use their power against my family. And so when I was younger, we moved into a predominantly white neighborhood and our house was raided regularly because neighbors or whoever apparently reported that they saw someone enter the house that fit whatever description of the crime that was committed blocks away or miles away. And so growing up, knowing that the police were there mobilized against you and then seeing them in your schools and then hearing of story after story of police not being held accountable for their often violent and destructive actions toward communities of color, it's also connected to what you just said, Megan. The fact that there are many layers to this. This isn't just one thing. This is not just about policing. This is about how neighborhoods were designed. This is about how schools were designed. This is about what is being taught in our schools.
Yeah.
And it's it's about all of the systems in our society and how they have been structured to elevate certain communities over others.
So I think one thing that comes up often, at least it has in the last couple of weeks, is, well, why can't we just reform the system? Okay, this policing system is broken. You know, it shouldn't be the way it is. Why can't we just reform it, right? Like, why not just reform? Why the talk about abolishing the police? And I think that there are people who are asking that question in good faith. I would have been asking that question in good faith like 5 years ago or so, just like, well, we can just reform it, right? Like, we'll just, you know, pull a little bit of like home renovation on the police, right? Like, we'll put a fresh coat of paint. It'll be fine. Why does that not work? Or what has Minneapolis done in attempts for that? Because this isn't the first murder that has hit national news coming out of Minneapolis. So, can you all help us get that in context a little bit?
So in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a big push among Republicans and Democrats alike to get tough on crime the crime, especially among Clinton era Democrats, to really crack down on urban environments. And this began a time in policing that was really based on trying to get as many Black people in prison as possible. And it was a concerted effort by both parties, happening on a lot of levels, because there was a sense in which you should just round up, if we just round up all the troublemakers and send them to prison, we'll be fine. And so this is where we saw a lot of houses that only had a single parent because they had been arrested for low-level offenses and given long prison sentences. We saw mass arrests. So coming out of this, there's a generation of millennials who are raised that traumatized by these events of the 90s and 2000s. They have extreme fear of the police, that there will be an escalation where we would see times where, particularly the Minneapolis police that were known to be corrupt, even among other police departments, they were known to be corrupt, where if the police threw a bag of weed into the trunk of the car, then they could get three strikes on you instead of just two, and then you would go to prison. This was happening regularly to meet quotas for prison sentences. So coming out of that, there was a generation of millennials and Gen Xers that were fed up and just completely traumatized and frustrated. And then Jamar Clark is killed in 2015, a year after Michael Brown is killed in Ferguson. And activists led primarily by Black leaders in the community occupy and tent outside of the precinct in North Minneapolis, which is the predominantly Black neighborhood and one of the formerly segregated neighborhoods in Minneapolis, a low-income neighborhood. And for months, in the middle of the winter, they're tenting out and demanding that the video of Jamar Clark's murder be released. The video was not released for months. The police kept tearing down tents. This was a very, by and large, peaceful protest. There was a few bad actors who, I think, used the peaceful protest as cover to do some things to get up to trouble. But by and large, the most violent thing that happened were white supremacists actually shot at the protesters. Those were the only really seriously injured people. We practiced standing in the middle of the freeway. We practiced all the nonviolent tactics. And eventually, after several months, the prosecutor let off the officers that killed Jamar Clark. And the police chief was asked to step down and was replaced by, we were promised reforms at that point. We were told that the chief would be a Black man who had largely positive referrals from people, that body cams would be worn, that trainings would be done. At that point, since 2003, we'd had $45 million in police settlements for excessive use force. So $45 million of Minneapolis taxpayer money had went to victims of police brutality by that point. And so people from an economic standpoint were getting fed up. Yeah. And they were required to do diversity trainings, implicit bias trainings. So the idea of reforming all really started in 2015. And we actually got a lot of national recognition in Minneapolis for all the reforms that we did.
Right. That's what you hear in Wisconsin. Is oh, look how well they're doing. So it's important to hear the other side of that, the not part that gets broadcast in Wisconsin.
Audre Lorde once said, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." And if we're talking about reforming one part of a system that is working the way that it was designed to work, we have to address the fact that we can't reform something that isn't broken.
Yeah.
And then if we talk about restructuring, that's a different conversation. I think that restructuring means that we prioritize public safety and public wellness.
Yes.
Reforming means we keep what we already have and really hope that it just changes when hearts and minds and priorities haven't changed.
One thing I would point out was that Derek Chauvin, the man, the racist man who murdered George Floyd, was a police trainer. He was training the two other officers. That was like their second or third time out, and he was their trainer, which shows you everyone's been at a training where nobody is going to do what they say. Right? And so there was two things happening in the Minneapolis Police Department at the same time. There was the public face of training, which was, let's watch the videos, let's have the kumbaya. This is how people talk about things when they don't want to do them. Mm-hmm. And then we'll send him out with Derek Chauvin and he'll show them how to do the real policing, which is find low-level young African-American men and Black men and rough them up. And if you don't do that, when you establish someone like Derek Chauvin, who is a sociopathic individual with deeply racist hatred for people of color, as a trainer, that's something really powerful to new people. It says, if you want to be a part of this police force, you need to be comfortable with this type of behavior. And if you're not comfortable with it, then it's time for you to leave.
Mm. Yeah.
We say that also with Bob Kroll, who is the union head of the police union in Minneapolis. He was elected with 400 of the 800 police officers' votes. And to give you a little sense of who Bob Kroll is, when Trump came to town, Bob Kroll decided to print Cops for Trump t-shirts. And wear them, march them through the protests, which he was charged with protecting both the protesters and everyone who was there. And then he didn't leave it at that. He introduced Trump on stage, which he knew would escalate the situation, which he knew would make the protesters more angry, which would then provide cover for him when he ordered and allowed the police officers to the protesters. This is the way this individual thinks. Who sends Derek Chauvin out as a trainer? Unless you have a very particular agenda, as Lawrence said, unless the system is working and you want it to work the way that it works. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example from me personally this week. When I was out peaceful protesting, I was standing at the end of my block with two young Black teenagers who had taken it bravely upon themselves to guard our block from white supremacists that we were told were coming to our neighborhood. And there was a community meeting that there should be shifts for protecting your block by standing at the end of the block the first night of curfew. Hundreds of people all over the neighborhood were doing this. And these two young Black men are outside, I think 17 and 19. And I go out on my bike to check on them. A group of four police officers pull up on us with their guns drawn. And when they said, are you guys smoking weed? And the reason why I believe they said this was so that when the body cameras started, there would be probable cause for them having drawn their weapons on us. Out so they couldn't see. And then they realized I was white. And when they realized I was white, they immediately tried to separate me from the situation. They pointed their gun at me and said, you need to leave. And I said, I'm not leaving. These two young men are protecting their our block. I live three houses down. They live four houses down. And they said, no, you need to leave. And I said, I will not be leaving until these two young men drive away. So they got in their car and drove the four blocks to their house. And the police officers perp walked me back to my house with a gun pointed at my back while two other police officers trashed my bike and slashed my tires. It was wanton cruelty and bullying. It was unchained, undisciplined behavior because they knew that there would be no consequences. Mm-hmm. They covered up their badge numbers so we couldn't see who they were. They got back in the car and drove away. And I truly believe that if they knew that I was white, that they would not have it rolled up on us that way. But it is this wanton disregard, choosing Derek Chauvin as a trainer, pulling up with guns drawn. Those two young men are traumatized.
One of the things that Black clergy were invited to do during these protests were to be the barrier between the police and the protesters. And I did that. And just as Nathan described, we weren't met with warmth, even I wearing a clerical collar, right? My skin is still black. And I was shot with rubber bullets and tear gas. And I think about how the system has been designed. If the neighborhoods were designed to protect white assets and white comfort, then the school systems were designed that way, then the police force will be designed to enforce any rule or action that supports the protection of white comfort and white property. And until that kind of mindset is shifted, I don't believe that reforms within the system as it is will be fruitful or effective.
I say, I think you said it best earlier, Lawrence, when you're just like, the system's not broken. This is how it's supposed to work. And for people who are outside of Minneapolis, or you know, what started to move me in this conversation over the last 5 years or so was coming to terms with that, because I grew up in a rural white community. And so I thought the first time I started to encounter stories of police brutality, I was like, oh, it's broken. And realizing that, no, this is what it's designed to do.
Yeah, I think that's really important for particularly white people who don't live in the city to understand that the function of police in urban settings and their job descriptions and is different, fundamentally different than it is in rural or suburban neighborhoods.
Yeah.
In rural suburban neighborhoods, the function of the police is to show up when things have escalated beyond what anyone else could handle. And I believe that most suburbanites and rural people assume that that is also the case in urban environments. It is not the case in urban environments.
No.
One of the things that has also led us here is that in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis police and the St. Paul police have been some of the only departments in our government that have never been cut. And only funding has only been increased because it is a sacrosanct, because no one wants to be the mayor that cut the police and then something bad happened.
Right.
And so as all these other things were being cut, street outreach workers for homeless, addiction centers, after school programs, all of these other budgets were being cut. And so there was less and less places to turn. And so the police became more and more the de facto, or don't call anyone at all. I live in Minneapolis for 12 years. I haven't called the police ever. And I've had drive-by shootings at my house.
Yep.
People have shot at my house and I don't call the police.
Right. Mm-hmm.
One, because I believe that they will slow roll in after 2 hours, after all the stuff is done, because they don't want to be involved. Mm-hmm. And two, because even if they do show up, I don't trust that they're going to help at all.
Right.
There were 3,000 untested rape kits in the Minneapolis Police Department. They have a 20% clearance rate for rape victims. They have a 50% clearance rate for murder victims. This would be unacceptable for any other department.
Yeah.
And yet we continue to add funding. And so what I'm saying is that it has become clear that the union, police unions often lead to increased violence. There is, DeRay has done work around this, where police unions are involved, people know that there is a legal team behind them. And police brutality goes up by up to 50% when there is a union. And I'm pro-union. Like, I'm a pro-union person, but I cannot stand by this union as an excuse for racist behavior. That is not what unions were designed to do. In my opinion, that's not what they ought to do. And so I believe that we have to fully defund the Minneapolis police and start over. And if we're going to start over, then we don't just have to rebuild the same thing we built before, because we have a new mission. Our mission is no longer to segregate our neighborhoods and fill our prisons. So what could the mission be? And that's what Minneapolis has been asking itself. What could the new mission of public safety be? And the question we've been asking ourselves is, when you call 911 for an emergency, what would you like to have happen? And that to me is like a really beautiful question. It's like a really inspiring question. Like, when you call 911, what do you want to happen? It's a question that we've never been able to ask.
Again, I think about, you know, the differences between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I grew up and still live in St. Paul after moving back. But I work in Minneapolis and I'm here more than I'm at home practically. But the communities of color that were designed, the neighborhoods rather, certainly see more police activity, and they certainly see more policing. What I wonder, though, is if there is police reform, and we ask what we want people to imagine happening as the best ideal for when they call the police, I think it'll come up time and time again of, you know, how can we secure the comfort and the protections of those who are the wealthier or the more influential in our society. I think you see an increase in offenses and an increase in arrests if you see an increase in policing and an increase in police presence in communities of color, specifically designed to act as barriers between white communities and black communities. And so if we've already stigmatized certain communities and then we use guards to protect other communities from those people, I think we need to do more rebranding and more redeveloping than reform. I certainly do believe that we need safety measures, but do we need police? And I'm saying this as someone who has a family member that is on the police department and cares for his family because he has that job. And so certainly people should be allowed to care for their families and keep society safe. I think, though, that we have to prioritize the safety of all citizens. And until we can change people's perspective of one another and eliminate the racists from the everyday guy who decides, or everyday female or everyday person that decides to join the police force, there's no test that we use to measure how woke or how racist someone is. And so they can be present in healthcare and in education and in police, then certainly we will have a continued presence of these problems.
Yeah, building on what Lauren said, we in Minneapolis are beginning to demand that when people show up, that they will have cultural sensitivity to our neighbors, that they will not be racist, and by not racist, I mean not just that you don't say offensive things, but that when you show up around people of color, you aren't afraid or angry.
Right. Yeah.
And Thirdly, we'd like people to show up who are trained to actually meet the needs of the moment. Mm-hmm. We don't need to be arresting homeless people who are struggling with mental health and addiction.
Right.
Jail is not treatment.
Right.
We don't need, what is the end game of sending police to pick up homeless people other than that you fear for your safety? Well, we can work on fearing for your safety, but these are nonviolent people. That my neighborhood has many, my neighborhood has over 500 tents where people are living in public parks. And it got so bad that the Minneapolis Parks Board decided that they would no longer allow the Minneapolis police inside the parks to interact with the homeless people because they would run chances with the people who are homeless dealing with mental illness then take their chances with the Minneapolis police. Mm. Can you imagine what it takes for government officials to make that choice, that we would rather have people living in tents with volunteer watch people than have police? That is how sick Minneapolis Police Department has become.
Yeah.
Mm. And,
well, and I just think back to the number you threw out earlier of $45 million, right, that was spent on settling cases of police brutality. You can do a lot of sustainable and low-income housing work for $45 million, like a good chunk of it. And so just thinking through not just what do we want to have happen when we call 911 and having our imaginations reignited by that question, but also the sheer amount of money. And it's not $45 million in Milwaukee, but it's over $30 million that was spent on police settlements. There's a lot of other things that need to happen in my city that I could use $30 million to do. That if I got to vote on that directly, and I knew that that was, I mean, I just got those budget numbers. It was the first time I'd even thought to look. I would like for that money to go to different things. And so Who's to say it can't happen?
Yeah. And similarly, when the news came that the Minneapolis public school system terminated their contract with the Minneapolis police as well, I think about how many, you know, school programs can be created or reinstated to support students that would alleviate a lot of the issues that I'm sure people were challenged with trying to figure out how to deal with, that led to perhaps the police engaging or being asked to engage in the first place. A lot of, and Nathan knows this with the work that he does, a lot of the, you know, behavioral issues that we see with students that aren't supported or don't have access to supportive resources that can't be mitigated by police presence. And there are people who need a lot of other resources, and that money can go to those resources. And so I do believe that we can have a system of community policing that prioritizes community and public safety, and that recognizes the value of all people that live in and make up our public.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody in Minneapolis who doesn't want to be safe. Yeah. And that seems to be the accusation leveled at us a lot by our suburban neighbors is like, oh, you must not want to be safe. And I was like, who doesn't want to be safe? That's like the base level of Maslow's hierarchy. That is the start of human development and safety. Right. I want to be safe, which is why I don't call the police.
Mm.
And so that's my motivation for not calling them.
Yeah.
So I do want to be safe. And as someone who's worked in the foster care system, in the public schools, in after-school programming, in churches, I would like to have a team of emergency responders that I can call and feel good about them showing up in appropriate ways. Unfortunately, that is not the Minneapolis police. And not enough police forces across America.
Yeah.
Yep. So I just think, you know, I want to kind of, building on what Lauren said about the schools, I was at the meeting before they decided to get police out of the schools. And there was a young man there who was a senior at North High in a formerly segregated black, now black neighborhood. And he said, we want to have our school officer, because if he goes, who will protect us from the other Minneapolis police officers?
Oh, wow. Wow.
It had gotten that bad that their best hope of being safe was to make friends with one Minneapolis police officer to keep them safe from the other officers. And the fact that they said that at a public meeting and didn't even understand how messed up that is shows how normalized police racism, brutality has become to the young people. And so when this is the level of normality, anger is going to be unleashed at some point. And that's what we've seen.
Sorry.
No.
And the school district paid $1.1 million for that.
Mm-hmm.
Every year.
I'm aware that things like that happen. And actually yesterday in Milwaukee, the first steps were taken to get the Milwaukee Police Department out of Milwaukee Public Schools, thanks to some organizing efforts of some wonderful young activists in our community through their organization is called LIT. But even knowing that, hearing the testimony of that young man in that hearing, like that just lands like lead in my stomach, right? Like I just feel like how, as a person of faith, right? Like, oh, like just that like deep grief. Mm-hmm. So I want to, as we kind of like round the bend on this portion of the conversation, because there's so many layers, this can go on and on and on and on forever. One of the things that strikes me as we continue to talk, and in my own experience too, is that you all are asking better questions about your community than I did growing up and than I did for many years, even living in Milwaukee. I think that so many people, and for the first 2.5 decades of my life, I just assumed that everybody was doing the best they could, right? That like our elected officials and our police and like everybody's just like, they all want what we want. Like everybody's doing the best that we could. And the thing that I have heard come up over and over again in talking with y'all today is, what if we imagined it differently? What if we asked questions about not just like, what's happening in that neighborhood, but why? And when did it start? And when did this violence start, right? That you started to have a militarized police presence defending one neighborhood from another in the 1950s, I think helps us start to think differently about what an appropriate level of response, and I want to like almost put air quotes around that, like appropriate response is now. Because when things strike national news, it puts something into our consciousness, you know, across the country of like this one flashpoint, George Floyd, you know, before that, Jamar Clark, before that, you know, any number of names we could list off at this point. But in reality, it's not the flashpoint. It's 1930, there was redlining. Mm-hmm. 1950, this police presence. And so, what questions would you all recommend people ask in their own communities, right? Because I think that while this is going to look different everywhere, you know, the point earlier about police in rural communities and suburban communities having different job descriptions than ones in urban communities, things are going to look different. But what questions can help guide people who are engaging this conversation, who are new to engaging this conversation in their own context? What would you recommend they ask of their elected officials and their social servants? And I say that term loosely.
A couple things that I found helpful in doing this work, because I've done this work in two different cities, the city that my church is in, which is a first ring suburb, that is an urban first ring suburb. And then I've done this work in Minneapolis. One, I asked people to look at old maps of their town and talk to the older people about what policing was like when they were growing up, who lived there when they were growing up, and then try to map those stories onto redlining and where people were legally allowed to live. And if you ask those questions in just open ways, sometimes, and you don't frame it as like, I'm trying to catch you being racist. You know, like, it's just like, I want to understand, like, what happened? Was this town ever a place where Black folks were roughed up after dark?
Sure.
And you just sort of ask in a historical way, not blame and shame. That helps to tell a bigger story. I think ask people when the first communities of color moved in, not just when individuals of color moved in, but when you started to see a diverse church, a diverse restaurants, when you started to see not you personally had a neighbor, but there started to be other ways of showing up in your community. I also always suggest that people ask for a racial breakdown of arrests by their local police department. And if they don't have the data or don't want to give you the data, you need to start demanding that data. Because you will be told that there's not a problem. You will be told that arrests are not racialized, but you won't know until you have the data. And a really important data point for what we're talking about right now is in Minneapolis, the city council asked the Minneapolis police not to arrest anyone for smoking weed on the corner. That was a low-level offense and we weren't supposed to do that. So arrests went way down to 67 in 1 year. But because they were keeping track of race, 46 of those were Black. There was only one person that was arrested for smoking weed on the corner in the whole year that was not Black. So there's one way to spin that, which is, look, arrests for marijuana are way down. But until you keep that racial data, you don't know that you're missing a big part of the story. So those are the pieces of information I really ask people as they begin to put together the story of their town. Lawrence, what do you?
I have the unique position of being a Black pastor of a predominantly white congregation. And this isn't a congregation that is passive or ignorant concerning these issues. And so I often get to ask these questions. So thanks for asking this question. One of the things, though, to consider is how you feel around people of color, how you feel when you are one of very few white people in the presence of people of color. How many friends of color, if you have children, do your children have? And how many have come over to your home to play or come to a party or things of that nature? And the people of color that you engage with, where do you engage them? Is it publicly? Is it, you know, in stores? Is it in professional settings? Is it in your neighborhood? And asking how you engage with people of color, and then what the expectations are around your being comfortable analyzing race, and not racism, but race. Because I believe a lot of white people, especially the professional, brilliant, amazing, go-to, you know, like type A personalities, they want to achieve this thing called anti-racism. They want to achieve this thing called peace. And so they're looking for the way to do that. And that way, it unfortunately isn't a checklist. One of the things, though, that I do say is that once you start to understand what it means to be white, and really asking yourself, what does it mean to be white in my context? That'll lead you to some of those other questions that Nathan was asking as well, because then you start to see patterns and behaviors that you perhaps weren't aware of before.
As a type A go-to, like, checklist loving white person, that hit a little close to home. It's good. It's good. And I just want to encourage people, even if you're in a smaller town. I found out last week that the town I lived in high school, which is like 80,000 people in Virginia, it has a redlining map and you can access it on the internet. And so even if you're not in a larger urban area, there's probably some of this data out there. I think that certainly where I grew up, it was like, oh, well, it's just a nice little hometown community, right? Like there was this myth of Southern niceness, which is a whole other episode. And so to be able to see like, oh no, there's a redlining map for the town I went to high school in. This was intentionally done there too. And yeah, so both that data point and then, what you're inviting us to, Lawrence, to consider, like, how do I feel around people of color? How do I feel when I'm the only white person in the room or one of the only white people in the room? Those are more uncomfortable questions to sit with from my experience in my own attempting to do this work. Those aren't sexy and they don't look good on Instagram.
But if fixing racism was fun, then we would have done it a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
It's not fun to fix racism. If learning about racial history was fun, we would have had days about it in elementary school. And if these stories weren't shameful, I've noticed a big difference between minority families and white families is that minority families tend to pass down stories of racial trauma and talk about them. And white families don't tend to talk about the racist crap their uncles did.
Oh, no.
So we are not aware of our own history of being white and what we have been complicit in and what our family is. It wasn't until I dug deeply that I began to realize that my family had run black families out of town, previous generations of my family. That's not something that's just going to come up. You got to start digging for that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would say on both sides, and this is by no means a way to protect anyone from their history, but I think it's a protective mechanism to pass down those stories because if I hadn't been told when I was a kid 30 years ago, 35 years ago, do not go to Minneapolis, especially at night, I might have engaged the police in a very different way growing up, but I was explicitly told stories to keep me safe and to keep me aware of the fact that we are living in a system that has been constructed on the basis of, white superiority and patriarchy and heteronormativity. And so when we are aware of that and not just the concepts, but when we're aware of, like you said, Megan, this is my own hometown. These are the things that happened in my own hometown. Then it makes us aware of our own complicit behavior or inaction, really.
Yeah. Well, that's good things to think through and good things for people to kind of look at Minneapolis almost as like a scaffolding of like, here are good questions to ask in your community. Here are good things for you to sit with. And so for the sake of time, if you're listening, we're dividing our conversation into two parts, because this is a lot. And it certainly could be even more. But for this one, thank you all for helping us get grounded in what happened in Minneapolis, and not just in the last 2 weeks, but in the last 90 years, because that's where we need to start. So if you join us next time on the Podluck, we can pick up on the second part of this conversation. But thank you both to Lawrence and to Nathan. for speaking with me today. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Podluck. This was the first of two episodes where I'm talking with Nathan Roberts and with the Reverend Lawrence Richardson about what's happening in Minneapolis, what has been happening, the history thereof, and how you can ask better questions in your own community, in your own life, as we all work toward a society in which everyone can be free and safe as we work for the liberation of all people. So thanks for tuning in. Please do join us next week. No, not next week, later this week for the second half of this conversation. If you haven't subscribed yet, go ahead and click subscribe. That way you'll know as soon as the second part of this episode hits the feed. Please check out the show notes for this show for more information about how you can find more of Nathan or Pastor Lawrence's work, where to find the other things that they're doing. And so also in the show notes, there are some other podcast links, different things that I've been listening to the last couple of weeks and continuing to sit with and to learn from and contemplate and grow from in my own life. So check those out as well. Until next time, this has been The Podluck. I'm Megan Westra. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll talk to you again soon.